I'm Craig Thornley, the race director for Western States. This is my third year as the race director.
And how did you get to know about the race?
In 1978, my family had just moved to Auburn Lake Trails to cool California. It's around the 85-mile mark. And back then, it was nowhere near as populated as it is now. It was pretty rural. And we were hanging out in the River Canyon, the American River Canyon, as often as we could. And one night we were camping near American Canyon Creek and had no idea that there was any event going on. And we saw some old, I want to not say old, but some very dirty, tired runner come by and ask us where the aid station was. And we didn't know what he was talking about, so we couldn't give him an answer. And then another one came along, and we found out they had run from Squaw Valley, and they were around 83 miles or so. You know, my brother and I were both just captured by the crazy look in their eyes, that not necessarily blank, but there was definitely a whole lot going on, and we both knew that we got to experience whatever they're experiencing, because you could read a lot into those eyes. And so we eventually, we worked at Dusty Corners Aid Station, which used to be Mile 40, for at least 10 or so years. And then I started running it in 2001. I have 8 finishes, all silver buckle finishes from 2001 to 2011, I think. So that's how I learned about it.
Can you also explain a bit more about the history of the race? How did it come about and when?
From what I have learned, Gordy Ainslie was riding the Tevis. He was a horse rider.
Now, for people who don't know the Tevis, give a bit of background on it.
The Tevis is the ride from Squaw Valley to Auburn. Wendell Roby had this vision of allowing people to enjoy the Western States Trail on horseback, and it was not intended to be a race. It was a ride. So Gordy was part of that. He was a big dude, adventurous guy, not at all a track athlete, but he obviously had something in his head that not too many of us at least were able to show that we had it. So he decides to run, and he did the math, whatever it was, 4.3 miles an hour, and it's like, I can do this. And when he finished it, just under 24 hours, because that's all they allow for the horses. The Tevis is not a 30-hour event. It's a 24-hour event. Dr. Lind at the time thought this was a once-in-a-lifetime thing. No one will ever duplicate this feat. Right? And now we're at 8,000 finish or something. But it was just so far out there to think about running in these kind of temperatures and this terrain. And he just started this crazy sport. 77 was the first year it was an event for the runners, but it was still part of the Tevis Foundation. And then after that year's race, the Western States Endurance Run was separate from the horses. But we still have a lot of the horse ideas, like the buckle idea came from the Tevis. I mean, most runners don't wear buckles and belts, so...
They wear them now,
but some of them do, but there's still a lot of people say, what the heck am I going to do with a buckle? The 24-hour cutoff, that came from the Tevis. The way we used to evaluate runners during the race medically was very similar to the vet checks at the Tevis. Horses can't tell you how they're feeling. People can, but we still, initially, we would take blood pressure, pulse, and I think weight also, and we gave full authority to the medical folks to pull a runner, no matter how you feel or what's going on in your head. But people didn't know as much either about their own body's response to this type of stress.
It's such a legendary race. Now, how difficult is it to get this job? It must be a very sought-after position.
Well, I don't know if people really knew what this job was about. I don't know if they really want the job. Let's start with how I got involved. I was not at all an event organizer. I have degrees in computer science. Was not an event organizer until I created Waldo 100K, in Oregon. And my wife, who is an event organizer, after that first year, she said, "Wow, you're pretty good at this event organizing. You could probably do this for a living." And that was way back in 2001 or two. I never thought that it could be my sole source of income to live off of. But I started developing Waldo, and it became a really well-respected race. It was a national championship. It's been in the Montreal Ultra Cup. I got to implement my ideas of what I thought a race should be like, treating every runner equally. First-class service at aid stations where the volunteers are very knowledgeable, and they take your bottles and they fill your bottles and they're helpful. You know, respecting all the other users of the trail during race day, just because you have a bib number doesn't mean that you have any more right on the trail than a hiker or someone on a horse or someone on a bike. I got to use it as kind of a playground, just as a learning tool. The race director job opened up, and I was a ski patroller in a national ski patrol at Willamette Pass, so I had a lot of board experience and on the hill, you know, medical response and just organizing a lot of people, including my trail work efforts. I was steward of 16 miles of the PCT, and so I had this skill set. And the experience getting to the interview in Davis was quite a story, too. I was helping Megan Arbogast at the Olympic Trials Marathon in Houston. I'd planned on helping her long before I knew I was going to be interviewed for the job. And they put it on the same weekend as the Houston Marathon. So like, what am I going to do? I'm committed to helping Megan. These guys want to interview me. Fortunately, it was the day after the Houston Marathon. So I got up early and got on a plane. And it was a three-plane trip from Houston to, it was supposed to be Oakland, and then a drive from Oakland to Davis. Well, we're sitting on the plane in Houston, 4:30 in the morning or 5 in the morning. We're sitting there, not going anywhere. Finally, the pilot gets on. We're having computer problems. Like, oh, my God. So I eventually get to Phoenix, and there's like 10 minutes before the flight to Oakland. I can't get on the plane, even though the plane's out there. They'd already shut the gates. So I eventually got a flight to San Francisco. We're like, you know, eighth in line to take off, and we're taxiing out, and we pull off to the side, and the captain gets on. There's flow control issues with San Francisco, so I was worried about how am I going to do on my presentation, and instead it's just become this massive stress just to get to the interview. And I finally get in the rental car line, and the person who was helping me asking all of these questions, "Well, would you like our FM satellite radio package?" "No, I'm fine." And the last question was about the navigation system. And I said, "It's already plugged in my phone. I know exactly where I'm going. I just want the car." She says, "Well, ours reroutes through traffic." It's Sunday. There's no one here. So I'm driving crazy fast, like 80 miles an hour on Interstate 80, and my navigation system's telling me how much time I have to get to this interview. And I'm a little stressed at this point, and I generally don't use deodorant, and I am reeking from the stress. I can't go into this interview smelling like this. So, but now I can't even stop. I mean, how in the heck what am I going to do? The interview of my life, and I smell so bad. So by driving fast, the navigation system is, I'm gaining, all right? I'm gaining time. So maybe I'll have 10 extra minutes instead of being right there at the start. So I eventually stop at this little Chevron Mart and looking around for deodorant. I've never bought deodorant at a Chevron Mart or gas station. I don't buy it anywhere. So I can't find it. So I asked the guy behind the counter, I said, "Do you have deodorant?" And he goes back and looks where the condoms are, and you know, the stuff that you apparently don't sell to kids, right? So I get this little thing of black suede, and I end up making it to the interview, and they had no idea that was what I had gone through that morning, but it was probably a good test to see if I could handle stress. So I got the job.
Fantastic. How much longer after that did you find out that you got it? How did you feel after all that?
Well, it was pretty close. The president, John Trent, called me within a couple days, and it was close to my birthday. So he told me that the day before my birthday, and I had a lot of friends coming over, and of course everybody wanted to know how the job went. And he said, you can't tell anybody yet because we have to notify the other folks who wanted the job. So I had all these people over at my house for my birthday, and I couldn't tell anybody that I had gotten the job.
Oh, wow. And now we just did 3 days, really, really well organized 3 days running on the track. There was so much stuff being taken care of. The race itself would be even bigger. How much work over how much time goes into making that all happen?
Well, yes, this is the only my only job. I don't have any other job. So it is full time. You would be amazed at, and I was amazed at this too. I was told some numbers like you're going to have to write 50 emails a day. And it just didn't seem possible that it could be more than what I was already used to handling. And, you know, being a computer system administrator, I responded to emails. That's all my users. They sent me emails. And the number of different things that I have to respond to on a daily basis, it's all over the place. You know, I may be dealing with a trademark issue or a sponsor issue or the myriad of emails I get from people who want to run the race and they have questions about the qualifying standards, or they want to give me advice on how to change the qualifying stuff, or my aid station captains, the volunteers, there's 1,500 volunteers, the agencies, the Forest Service, the state, insurance companies. It's just mind-blowing how many things come in. But I have really, really good people now. And I think yesterday or this last weekend, what a lot of people said, wow, this is really well organized. Well, I really wasn't doing a lot on those 3 days. What you saw this last weekend was more of my managers and my captains and my key volunteers just taking the ball and running with it and having a good time. And the runners really responded and they had a good time.
And you've got a pretty star-studded cast on your aid stations, really. I mean, you go by and you get, you know, Tim Tweetmeyer offering you to refill or whatever, and Tracen wondering what you need, and Megan Abergast checking the roads. You know, it's pretty incredible, all these people. I mean, how does that all come together?
Oh, wow. Yeah, it was pretty special. At Michigan Bluff, I don't know how many of those people you got to interact with, but there was Billy Davis and Ray Scannell and Joan Scannell and Carol Hewitt, lots of runners from the 80s and 90s with a passion for the event that is pretty unmatched. I think everybody who was out there, they've all been impacted and affected by the race and the trail, and they love sharing it with other people.
And also, I mean, it's a full-time job. At the moment, that's nearly hard to imagine because you've got the race. And then they go, you know, what are you doing in September? What is your full-time job in September? Just explain a bit more what's actually happening behind the scenes.
Well, we have a board, a 13-member board of directors. We meet 4 times a year. And policy is decided by the board, and I have to implement it. And Western States has a lot to offer. You know, we're very proud of our contributions in medical research and trail stewardship and race organization. We're proud of those, and we want to share all those with the rest of the world. So we are more involved in the international level than we have been in the past. So we joined UTWT. We're part of the International Trail Running Association. I'm involved in ITRA, the International Trail Running Association, as a on the steering committee. But getting back to the race, you know, a lot of the bigger ideas and the higher level thinking happens in the fall. And then we get right into the lottery, which is probably a more challenging event to put on. Lots of eyes scrutinizing everything we do in that lottery with 25 or 600 applicants for the 270 spots. And, you know, we do it live. So you have to be absolutely spot on. And now that we have these exponential ticket counts, so each consecutive year that you're not drawn in the lottery, you get twice the number of tickets that you had the year before. So we got people with 32 tickets. Next year, there'll be a few with 64 tickets each. So it gets pretty complex. getting those tickets created and doing all the math to calculate the probabilities. But it's fun. I love the pressure of it. And I've got some really good people helping me implement all that math and probabilities and whatnot.
And how do you keep selection of people fair? If you've got so many applicants, you know, there's some races who go more, they prefer the elite runners, then there's some who do only lottery, you know. How did you decide to mix that?
Well, this is the board, and the board has been very, very good at, you know, resolving this tension between the elite field and the, you know, the egalitarian. Every man has the same opportunity to run this race, right? In order to be a relevant race, you got to have an elite field, right? If you don't have an elite field, you're not going to get the attention. You're not going to get the sponsors. You're not going to be able to do the trail stewardship and the research. The race just won't be as relevant without an elite field. And so you have to pay attention to that elite field at the same time, making it as fair as possible for the 30-hour runner to get into the race. And we're continually making sure that we're resolving that tension exactly where the board wants it resolved. And I think right now we are right at it. We have 20 spots in the Montreal Ultra Cup. We have 20 possible spots from the top 10 men and women from the year before. We have 6 elite Fournette entrants from UTWT. And then we have automatic spots for race admin, which every running club that staffs an aid station gets to designate a runner in the race. Doesn't matter how fast they are. And our sponsors each get a spot if they're a certain level sponsor. And then it's lottery after that. And the way we have designed the qualifying races and qualifying standards, we don't think that any trail 100-miler is an easy 100-miler. So the runners vote on the best races out there, the highest quality. And then the 100K, which we only had, I think, 7 of those in the United States last year. The qualifying times for those, somewhere around 75 to 80% of the field. We're not excluding very many people. If you get into one of those 100Ks, you know, you finish in the top 80%, you will have achieved a qualifying standard for Western States. So it's not at all an elite time through that. And then we give you tickets for each consecutive time you qualify and enter the lottery. So eventually, if you've tried hard enough, you've been able to get a qualifier every year, which is a lot of work, right? You got to run 100-mile or 100K every year and get your name in the lottery. You will be rewarded by getting a spot in the race.
And where does the cap come from? There's a very specific number that's allowed in every year. Where did that start?
So the Granite Chief Wilderness was created in 1984. And in the United States, no organized events are allowed inside wilderness areas in general. You couldn't just go apply right now and try to put a new race through any wilderness area in the United States. You won't get anywhere. But the Tevis, Western States, after a 4-year legal effort, we were grandfathered in. We're allowed to continue to use the section of the trail through the wilderness at the same levels of pre-wilderness. So for Western States, that was 369 starters in 1984. And we're allowed to achieve that 369 number over a 5-year rolling average. So we'll go up and down and up and down. Right now we're a little bit over, primarily because in 2008 we had a fire and there were no starters, so there was a compensation after the zero, and the average was low until you take the zero of 2008 out. The zero really helps an average, but when the zero's gone, those compensation years, somebody has to pay the piper. So there's a little bit of downward pressure right now on the number of entrants, which is not fun, and I wish we could have more, but that's where the 369 comes from.
And looking at the thousands that want in and the very few that can go in, I mean, how often do you receive special gifts in the mail or other sort of?
No one has offered me money or cars or no. You know, there's definitely a lot of requests to get into the race, and it's usually off of what people think are their own merits that deserving, and 90-something percent of those we reject. We can't accept. I mean, just ask Gordy about all the special requests he asked me about. Like, no, Gordy, no. You have to run a qualifier. You can't have a pacer from Deadwood. I just not swayed by that. So, and people know that. My brother ran Waldo 100K his first time, and we give hats to anybody who finishes before 9 o'clock, 9 p.m. And he finished after 9 p.m. And, you know, people said, oh, you got to give your brother a hat. I'm not giving my brother a hat. He didn't finish before 9 p.m. So that's who I am. I'm not going to, no.
How do you see the race evolving in the next few years? Where do you want to take it?
Well, I definitely want to see us involved in the international scene. We're already making contributions by being involved in UTWT, Ultra Trail World Tour, and the International Trail Running Association. I want to see the race continue to be relevant on the competitive scene in the world, attracting the top 100-mile runners of the world. And at the same time, I want to make sure that I continue to implement what the board wants in terms of the egalitarian, that every person who comes to Western States has an experience, whether you're 30 hours or 14 hours, that you have an experience that will be unmatched. It will be a memorable day of your life. You will not forget your experience at Western States. So I want to make sure that we still do that. And I think you probably saw that this weekend at the training runs. You know, everybody, whether it was the person being swept up by the sweep or the people in the front, you know, everybody's treated the same. And we're very aware of every person's experience out there. You know, I want to continue to evolve our medical practices based on the research that we've done primarily at Western States, but also at some other races in the world, make sure we're following the latest protocols on treating runners. And we're already making significant changes in that area in the last 2 years. Like, you won't see IVs started. You won't see normal saline being pumped into runners anymore, which is a big change in culture here. We learned from our research that the risk of exacerbating hyponatremia with normal saline is greater than the benefits that you might think you'd get from trying to flush the kidneys out with more fluids. So we've been trying to reduce the number of even IV starts. And most people who get themselves into trouble here, they're going to resolve quickly on their own without much medical intervention. People come to Western States, they're trained, they're fit, they're really healthy people, and just stop, rest, lay down, get your body to stop producing those stress hormones, and you will normalize quickly. And when we do get a case of hyponatremia where you're symptomatic, we know now that we can give people hypertonic saline, which is three times the normal saline of your blood, your body, and that if you're not hyponatremic, it won't hurt you. And if you are hyponatremic, it will help you equalize your sodium in your blood and your body much faster. Those are pretty significant changes. I want to make sure we continue to evolve and not just be static. You know, we've always done it this way, so we're going to continue to do it that way. I want to make sure we continue to lead the sport and have the best practices in everything. And I want races to be able to look at us and use our procedures, our policies, ask us if they want help. We'll gladly provide input. But at the same time, on the world scene, you know, there's a lot for us to learn too. My wife and I went to UTMB last year and watched that organization, and they are doing a lot of things that we don't do well. They're doing them better than us. So, you know, it's a two-way street in this international collaboration, and I think we're going to benefit from other races as much as we're going to be able to contribute and help them.
Is that the main reason to be part of ITRA? Because, I mean, the concern that this race could fall back in terms of relevance seems pointless nearly, because it is so famous, it is the oldest race. Like, I cannot imagine that it would ever lose that status. Or do you think there's a danger that could happen?
Oh, there's definitely a danger it could happen. Oh, absolutely. When we only have 369 runners, and UTMB has 2,200 in their 100-miler and 7,500 in all five of their events, you know, I could see it slipping, and I don't want it to slip. There are a couple of examples of races that used to be more relevant and have dropped off. And I don't want it to happen under my watch, right? I feel that responsibility.
But I mean, on the other hand, I was at CCC last year as well. And it's a massive event. And as such, also the fun I found isn't as big because you're constantly packed in such a massive amount of people, you know, especially if you're slower like me. So this race was such an incredible experience that I think people value very highly compared to those massive events.
Yeah, I think you're correct, but they also want to run something, right? They want to do something iconic, and UTMB is definitely iconic, running around that big old mountain. That's a big deal. That's a big experience. So they're different experiences, but I'm not afraid that we're going to become irrelevant, but it's definitely a concern.
And could you explain to me how you manage financing? Because the race entries, you know, people might complain that they're high, but if you think about all the work that goes into it and you're working on it full time and everything else that has to be done, it's very little. So where does the money come from?
The total, we're nonprofit, so our 990s are available, publicly available. You can go look these up. We generally have about a third of our income coming from sponsorship, a third or so from the race entry fees, and then the other third is from donations and our raffle and our training runs. If it wasn't for the sponsorship, we would have been at $650 for an entry fee. Right now it's $370 American dollars. But part of the expenditures are medical research and our trail preservation. We're also involved in effort right now to buy 10,000 acres west of Granite Chief, private land. We have to get permission every year to go through this land. They're owned by timber companies in Atlanta, Georgia. And this effort by the American River Conservancy is almost closing here. It looks like it's going to happen. It'll be $10 million to purchase these 10,000 acres and put them in public trust forever, so we'll have permanent, you know, access to the trail. We won't have to get permission. And we've been involved in that. We're going to contribute some of our reserve funds, and the public, our runners, our constituents, were asked for make donations, and they responded better than we hoped. So I think combined we're putting in $100,000 into that effort, and we'll always be looking at those kinds of issues and spending money when it's appropriate. And the cost of the buckle alone is almost the same as the entry fee. The cost of the buckle this year to us, the silver buckle, is $355. So if you get the buckle, you got your entry fee back without any of the other stuff that you got. That's a pretty amazing figure right there, that the cost of the finisher buckle is almost equal to your entry fee. Yet we can still provide a race with a professional race director and all the supplies out there on the course and the permits and the shuttles and all the stuff that you get as a runner. It's still amazing that the entry fee is only $370, that we can do it. The sponsors, I would like to continue to see that grow before we raise the entry fee. I'd like to see more income coming from our sponsorship, and you know, our international exposure, I think, will help us become more attractive to bigger sponsors, and being part of UTWT gives us exposure all over the world. So going back to the international, it's not just that I'm worried about becoming irrelevant, but in order to be successful, we have to be attractive to sponsors and to be able to keep the entry fee low.
You mentioned that buckle. That has a whole history as well.
The Western States buckle has been created by this company called Comstock Heritage, multi-generational company. Started out as a badge company, like for police and fire in San Francisco. And they created our buckles. Now they're in Reno. And they make our buckles every year. And it's a pretty fun process. If you haven't seen the video that we posted, it's on our website. You know, every single buckle is custom, really, truly custom. They solder on the words, 100 miles, Western States Endurance Run. So none of those are going to be exactly the same. And then the engraver is one of the last steps. And he puts on birds and clouds on the buckle. The first time I went and watched this process, I was wearing one of my buckles, and he was explaining how he puts on birds, and I didn't have any birds. So he put birds on my buckle right there. But and they're totally into it. This is the first year they're going to be at the finish line engraving the names of the winners of the buckles. Every person who gets a buckle is going to have their name engraved on it by the artisans from Comstock Heritage. So they're not endurance runners. They don't run Western States, but we've been talking to them and sharing with them how this buckle means so much to runners, and they're totally engaged, and they're excited that they get to make the buckle that so many people want to earn. You know, it's not just that it's a $355 buckle, but it's what that buckle represents, right? That whole effort, commitment, not on race day alone, but just getting to the race and preparing and all the sacrifices. And it's symbolic of a whole lot more than just a finish time.
And the process, like if someone hears this and says, I really want to do this race, it sounds amazing, what do you have to go through to get there?
Well, you have to run a qualifying race off of our qualifying list within the qualifying period, which is generally the year before the lottery. The lottery application period is in November, and put your name in the lottery. Then the lottery drawing's the first weekend in December, and if your name gets drawn, then you have to do 8 hours of volunteer service to the ultra running community. In terms of, it could be either trail work or it could be volunteering at a race, and then train for the race, show up in Squaw Valley, and run to Auburn.
Western States Race Director Craig Thornley there. Thanks for listening to Trail Chat. I'm Nikki Riedel.